Hello, hello. You're listening to Near Distant, and on this episode, I'm in conversation with my boo, Casey Crawford, about the erosion of truth, the purchase of Twitter, and the gorgeous beauty of baseball player unions. So, we'll take you out to the ball game, babe. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right. Hello, hello. Welcome to Near Distant, the podcast where time doesn't exist, but we're still trying to improve the near distant future. Today, I'm talking with my partner, Casey Crawford, but let's have you introduce yourself as if I don't know who you are.
Okay. Well, hello, person that I've never met before. Welcome to my apartment. This is my couch. This is my cat. I'm Casey Crawford. I am 29 years old. I am a cishet dude, and I live in Berkeley, California. I have like worked primarily my entire career as a cybersecurity professional, but right now I'm sort of going through some changes there. So unsure what the future holds in that regard. And some things that really interest me are, I really like animals, huge sucker for anything that walks on four legs. I really like sports, in particular baseball and basketball. I spend a lot of time with my family who lives in the area here. Big reason why I moved here in the first place. And yeah, I, like you, got a degree in American culture studies. Well, I know you were just broad history with sort of
American history.
Yeah. So we have that in common. And yeah, just sort of living in this crazy country that we're all trying to make sense of.
Mm-hmm. With the help of Costco.
With the help of Costco, yeah.
And Bath and Body Works candles.
Definitely.
Which are probably your two primary vices.
We have one going right now, actually. Fresh fall morning.
Fresh fall morning. I mean, it's got to set the mood. We are recording in the morning after a lunar eclipse in Taurus. So a fitting time for there to be a U.S. election. Mm-hmm. Eclipses, for those who are uninitiated in the cult of astrology, typically happen in like October, November. So it's just quite strange that that is when U.S. elections are
happening. Is there a reason for that?
I don't know.
No. Okay.
I don't know. I just know this astrologer that I follow, Chani Nicholas, like made this point in like a recording the other day. And I was like, huh. And then I was texting with Devin this morning and I was like, it's so funny to me in a cosmic way that Ronald Reagan had like a staff astrologer. And the one good thing that he could have done for this country would be to change when the election cycles are, if he believed, because eclipses are supposed to bring about like these like massive changes. Massive being a relative term, right? Like they're usually about like purging something or there being some sort of change. So because like US politics is like two party, it's not surprising that it's sort of like there are these like big shifts that happen every like election season. So part of the, I don't know, part of me wonders like what politics would look like if it weren't tied to this sort of like astrological phenomenon. Whether or not you believe in astrology at all, it would just be interesting to see like if voting happened at a different time of year, what it would be like.
Totally. Yeah. One other thing I want to point out. This is my podcast debut. Britain, I'm ready now. But yeah, I do want to sort of set up what we're doing and what's going on with this show. I mean, I have a somewhat of an idea, but I'd love to lay down the tracks a bit more so that I don't go off the rails.
Yeah. Yeah. So, thank you for that. So Near Distant, the idea is that the first path kind of us talking is talking about a topic that is in the near, in the now, that has kind of preoccupying our brain space, physical space, and then segueing into the near distant future. So what we want that to look like, maybe some things that we can see happening that we want to see grow in the near distant future? And then what are like a handful of things that we can do as individuals to start building towards a future that we actually want to live in? So yeah, with that in mind, what's been on your mind? What's near?
Totally. Well, I think as you mentioned, today is November 8th, Tuesday, November 8th, lunar eclipse in Taurus. And so for me, you described me as secular the other day, and I tried not to take that as an insult. but yeah, the election has been something that has been sort of flooding my, you know, social media.
Inbox.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Money. Yeah. I don't even have the money to give them. They're really barking up the wrong tree here. But yeah, I think the election has been a big thing. And then I think something else that's really preoccupied me recently has been sort of the recent tech bust, if you will, and then that coinciding with this recent takeover of Twitter, which is sort of the social media platform that I use the most. I had a realization a month or two ago. I don't know if listeners use Twitter, but they basically remind you every year on the day that you signed up, like, you've been on Twitter for X years. And so I recently in October, early October, got the notification, you've been on Twitter for 13 years. And like I said, I'm a 29 years old. So that means that in 3 years, I will have been a Twitter user for half of my life. And so that kind of caught me off guard and made me think about things differently. I was like, oh my gosh, this service has been like a part of my upbringing since, you know, I was 16 years old. And so I think recently with the news that Elon Musk purchased the site for $44 billion, then tried to get out of the purchase of the site, went to court, basically had to buy the site, and now we're watching it, how he's treating it in real time. That's sort of been what I've been preoccupied with. Yeah.
So I hadn't put it, or I hadn't thought about it in this way, but like, it's almost like Elon Musk's takeover was like a coup, and like he tried to fail the coup himself by backing out of the deal, and then it still happened. And like, I mean, we were kind of talking about like why he would even buy Twitter and landed on the idea of like, well, Twitter is sort of like the space where people like there's room to make fun of him. And yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about like the equalizing force that Twitter has been in like the 16 years or 13 years that you've been using it.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely changed over that time. I think when I first joined, it was unique because it was a social media platform that allowed sort of creative output within certain confines, the confines being 140 character limit. Whereas, you know, the other rival media networks that emerged during the 2000s, they were much more about sort of a sense of like presenting yourself, whether that was your MySpace page or your Zanga or whatever blog you would, you know, run your, you put in your HTML scripts to try and make it unique. Twitter basically said, you're not unique. You have 140 characters. What can you do with them? And, you know, your page will look the same as everybody else's page. And I think the great service that Twitter came to provide over the years was sort of an accessibility to celebrities in a way that we didn't necessarily have before. You know, a lot of celebrity output had been very curated or meticulously thought before it reached the public eye. And then the social media platform emerged where you could really see them and their thought process emerge in real time. And
they could also clap back, right? Like they could interact. Like part of me, like as you're talking, made me wonder like, I wonder like if Britney would have had like the same breakdown that she did with like the paparazzi if Twitter had been around.
Totally.
Because she could have very publicly been like, I'm dealing with like postpartum depression. Like, please stop harassing me and my family. Like, it's definitely a space for like celebrities being humanized as well.
When I'm, as I mentioned at the top, I'm a big basketball fan. And one of the eternal questions that people always ask is, what would it have been like if Michael Jordan had to interact with Twitter people? Because he's just this hyper competitive guy. He's this, you know, he was addicted to gambling. And to see like, what if people were able to make fun of him or, you know, tease him the way that they tease LeBron James? And so just the nature of celebrity has changed because of the accessibility we have to them. So, you know, I think all things Twitter have been really on my mind recently as I feel like we are watching the platform somewhat implode, for better and for worse. I think, you know, Twitter has been this, like you mentioned, sort of great equalizer. But at the same time, you know, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is how it's also contributed to this erosion of truth. And we're seeing that really heavy in sort of the election cycle now and sort of election subversion and like conspiracy. And I think Twitter has really lended itself to that. So I think it's sort of all these factors on election day, no less, that are like, oh man, like social media, we always knew it could be this toxic thing, but now we're really seeing it play out.
Yeah. And it's like playing out in a different way than Cambridge Analytica, which like used all of like that data that Facebook had collected to like target people specifically.
Yeah.
Twitter is maybe like more a place where people are opting in and like being radicalized.
Yeah.
Which is almost, it's also different than like YouTube where, or like TikTok where like you watch like one video and you're like four steps away from like really radical, like chauvinist, meninist, far right content. Twitter is sort of like different.
Yeah, well, I think it's because of like what you said, you sort of opt into who you follow, whereas the other services that you just mentioned, they select for you algorithmically like what you see, and like your For You page, like people, I don't know, for like TikTok, for example, I follow like 5 to 10 people. I'm on TikTok like 5 minutes a day when I'm in the bathroom, and that's pretty much it. But I think Twitter, it's like you have to opt into following somebody, and once you do that, that's like a conscious decision. And that is sort of the decision that reinforces the echo chambers that have sort of come to define modern politics. And so when we hear about, you know, various right wing or far right officials talking about election denying of the 2020 election, there are people that have just sort of consciously opted into this thought process. And so having a space that affords people that opportunity, I think we're realizing how dangerous it is. And I think that's something that's really, been on my mind recently in sort of the near part of the show.
Yeah. I want to talk about the truth part because we watched John Oliver last night, which usually we watch before we go to bed because I find his voice so soothing and calming. But I was awake for this one. And it was all about election subversion and how the far right Republicans have basically started putting in their own officials. And the way that they're doing it is also by like sort of threatening and scaring people who used to be running elections out of it. Because there's this whole lie going on in far right media that the 2020 election was rigged. So Trump, who gained a lot of prominence on Twitter, has continued to like use it as a tool to further these complete lies. So yeah, I wanted to talk to you about kind of like the nature of truth on Twitter, especially as it like regards to politics.
Well, yeah, I think we're seeing an erosion of it. I think that's like the primary point. And, you know, as you're well aware, like Trump has been banned from Twitter. He was banned shortly after the January 6th riots. And so he's been primarily spreading his word on a social network called Truth Social, of all things.
LOL.
So, but we are seeing, you know, like Tucker Carlson is still on Twitter. There are tons of...
Oh my God, Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
Do you know why he's a Republican?
No.
Okay. So I like once like Wikipedia'd him because I was like, why is this like thumb? Like, like why? Why?
Yeah.
And so basically what happened was that his mom, like in the 60s or 70s, basically like left his dad and joined like a commune or something. And that's like it's a mother wound like the core reason why he hates like leftists
and women
is because his mom like left.
Got it.
I think he has a brother. Yeah. So his dad raised him and his brother. So I'm sure that also like, let's be real, like the vitriol that Tucker Carlson has for like women and people that don't look like him is so bad. Like I'm sure his mom probably had reasons for leaving.
Yeah, let's be honest.
I'll just say that. Also, yeah. Like, women couldn't have their own bank account until the 70s. So there's probably, like, other reasons as well.
Yeah.
I won't speak too much on that, but I think it's, like, very interesting that, like, it's yeah, a literal, like, mother wound.
Yeah. Well, he's, like, the worst possible output of, like, the patriarchy. Like, he is, like, you know, the example of what the patriarchy can produce, you know, on an individual level. And then the way that he influences groups of people, here we are. But I think to go back to your first question about sort of, like, how truth is evolved on Twitter, I think, or I should say devolved, I think we talked a little bit about, like, I was trying to find sort of a point where this turned, like, when did this all start? And to bring it really full circle, to really, you know, illustrate that, yeah, time does not exist. Time is a flat circle. It's like, it probably, if I had to pinpoint, it would be when Donald Trump spread the lie on Twitter that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And, like, people just ran with that. And it you know, allowed him to emerge into a place of prominence where he was able to launch a successful campaign for the presidency. And since then, it's just devolved into things that we're seeing today where, you know, I know we've talked about it, but to give a little bit of context, like the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, her husband was just attacked in his home in San Francisco. So it's sort of a local story for us, but, you know, it's also a very national story. And what's happened has, like, the right has basically spun up the conspiracy theory that has allowed them to sort of escape culpability in the way that their rhetoric can radicalize somebody. So the theory, I mean, I don't know if you want to go into
Yeah. So basically, like, the story is that this guy who attacked Paul Pelosi was radicalized online and was also, like, retweeting conspiracy theories, which have been debunked, and is just sort of, like, exactly who you would imagine to be, like, a far-right conspiracy theorist, QAnon kind of character. So he went to the Pelosi's home and, like, broke in and attacked Paul Pelosi, like, with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And you were telling me more about, like, how quickly the far right spun up their own conspiracy theory.
Yeah. I mean, as somebody, I would consider myself deeply online in the Twitter context. I think it's the thing that I use most. I don't even want to look at my screen time app and have it expose me for how much I'm on Twitter on my phone. But I remember telling you the day of, like, they're trying to spin this. I remember seeing the hashtag Pelosi gay lover and telling you, like, right off the bat, I'm like, this is what they're trying to do. And then within 48 hours, that conspiracy had been adopted amongst these sort of fringe journalists who, you know, are able to feign some sort of credibility. And then all of a sudden, the alt-right, the masses of the alt-right believe it. And really what it is it's an attempt it seems to be an ongoing successful attempt to distance themselves from it by saying, oh, well, it has to be this gay lover story because otherwise they're confronted with the truth that the rhetoric and lies that they spit out ultimately radicalize people into this violent, like, radicalized action. And so they want to escape that by sort of pinning it on literally anything else. And so I think just as time goes on, we're seeing these theories become more and more just ridiculous. Yeah.
And it's like, it's just, the core of it is, like, the inability to, like, look in the mirror. Like, it mm-hmm. makes me think mm-hmm. about, like, mm-hmm. how they react to critical race theory, which yes. is literally just history.
Like, or the whole thought that, like, schools are putting litter boxes in classrooms to cater to, you know, to furries, and that like speaks to this whole, like, transphobia and
yeah.
you know, it ultimately you're totally right. It's just an inability or a
refusal
to look in the mirror because ultimately they're scared of what they might see or the ways in which they hold them, like, they just resent themselves.
And I think they'd see a lot of emptiness. I think
yes.
like Nell Painter is a Black historian who writes about, like, the creation of whiteness.
Mm.
And I think she kind of talks about this, of, like, if white folk were to like look in the mirror, they would have to confront like the history of violence, mm-hmm. like the lack of morals, the lack of ethics, like the lack of like a spiritual center, which is ironic considering, you know, there's the anchor of the like far right is like Christianity.
Yeah.
But even that, it's like still a hollow version.
Mm-hmm.
And like the act of like rebuilding from that kind of like negative space is really hard.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go back because you were talking about like these ideas promoted by fringe journalists,
mm-hmm.
which I think is generous of you. And kind of like bring it back to Twitter.
Sure.
Because Twitter is a space that has been kind of an equalizer. Mm-hmm. Like not only did we have access to, or do we have access to celebrities and politicians in a way we didn't before, but we also have access to each other in a yes. way that we didn't have before. And like the 140 character limit, which is a little bit bigger now, was just like a space to kind of share ideas and random thoughts and really like build communities like across borders geographically. But the fringe journalist is interesting and it ties back into like how truth is being eroded because of this new thing that Elon Musk is trying. So yeah. not only did Elon Musk buy Twitter because he was tired of being made fun of and challenged in this equalized space. If anyone else knows why he bought Twitter, let me know. But that's like, that's what, how I understand
Nobody
it.
Knows. Nobody knows.
But Twitter has not been profitable for 8 out of the 10 past years. So now he's bought this sort of failing business.
It was not a sound business decision. Yeah.
But also it's like interesting because like, is Twitter a business, you know? So yeah. it's like Twitter is like a public sphere. Twitter yeah. is like a space. But anyways, he's been trying to figure out how to monetize and, you know, make this $44 billion investment an investment mm-hmm. rather than just like a sunk cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that he's doing is trying to charge for the verified blue mm-hmm. check marks.
Yeah. I mean, he's trying to sort of quote unquote, like democratize the truth, which is such a slippery slope because I think, you know, the fringe journalists that we're talking about, I think Twitter has really given rise to the belief, well, if it walks like a journalist and it talks like a journalist, it must actually be a journalist. And I think you and I can both sit here and know that that's just not true. You know, like these people that, you know, cultivate sources and work for reputable news outlets, like they go through years, they devote their lives to it. And then you have somebody, and this happens on both the left and right. This is not exclusively a right-wing thing. I mean, I can think of all the Trump reply guys, right? Who mm-hmm. would just, you know, make fun of him and dunk on him in Twitter. And it's like, you're not doing anything, you know, you're just, but they would amass these giant followings. I can think of like they were like the Krasenstein brothers. They were like these left, like two people. But yeah, I think what we're seeing is people are willing to believe narratives that comfort them and that cater to their worldview, both on both sides. But particularly on the far right, it's becoming increasingly dangerous. And it's
the far right is like becoming like normalized. Mm-hmm. Like the far right is now just the right.
Yeah.
It's just like the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Whereas I would say that leftists are still left of yeah. like the Democrats and far left of the Democrats. So there's still like a splintering there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like the far right, Tea Party, Republican, libertarian, like they're all sort of in this mush pot.
Yeah.
And they're working together. And they have been since the 70s.
Yeah.
Fuck the Shafleys.
It's been a while.
But like these, yeah, the walk like a journalist, talk like a journalist. Now they have like the possibility of buying mm-hmm. their verification, like buying their legitimacy.
Yeah.
So when we're thinking about like a world where all these people are already so far gone, they can like look to Twitter, which has for like a long time been a bastion of, you know, an equalized space where people can share facts and myth. Now, yeah. like the myths are being verified.
Yes. Yeah. I think we're entering a pretty dangerous space where the closest thing we've had to a public, like a online public sphere. And granted, you know, no public sphere will be perfect. There will be voices that won't be heard that need to be heard, and voices that are amplified that shouldn't be amplified. But this is, it really is the closest thing we've had. And to see sort of this verification via payment is just, you know, it makes you wonder sort of like, who are the actual arbiters of truth? Is there such a thing as an arbiter of truth in this like sort of day and age? And if the answer is no, I think we're sort of confronted with like, what do we do in that void? And, you know, I think Twitter was never going to solve all of our problems or be that place, but, you know, to watch it sort of succumb to these really nasty human instincts and sort of, you know, now be owned by this like maniac. We're confronted with it in sort of the short term reality more than ever.
Yeah. A maniac, just like totally devoid of empathy and only driven by ego.
Yeah. An egotistical maniac. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. So I think it is, it's dangerous. And, you know, that's been, as we get to the point where I think, you know, later tonight, you and I will doom scroll and look for election results in states like Georgia and Michigan and Arizona. Like, you know, I think it's just going to be such a weird dystopian view into what it could look like if there isn't that sort of like, you know, mutual understanding of like, yeah, like the truth matters more than me being right. And I think we've watched that sort of devolve into people caring more about being right than what's actually true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes me think about the John Higgs podcast episode I sent you. So John Higgs is this author who writes about the KLF, which is this British techno band that was really, really big in the 90s. And then they kind of wanted to erase their memory from...
What did they do again? They like burned something, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. So they decided that they didn't want to be famous anymore. They had like bought back all of their records and basically kind of like erased themselves from record stores and everything, stopped doing press. And then they took a friend who was like a videographer. They went out to like a small Scottish island with like their last of their money, which was like £1 million, and just burned it.
Yeah, that's right. They just burned it. Yeah.
And it was really interesting because after they did that, they were like, why did I do that? And people, the podcast, which I'll link in the show notes, kind of explores it and is really, really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. Because people were more mad at that than if they had like spent money on like drugs or whatever. Like the idea that they were like burning capital.
Yeah.
But
so how does that relate to sort of...
Well, so he writes about the KLF in that they were kind of working to create their own reality. And, you know, part of that was also like, how do we like remove ourselves from this reality? Mm-hmm. And the whole podcast episode is really interesting and gets into like... how reality is constructed and talks about like modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism. So there are these different like schools of thought, but basically like modernism was like born of the Industrial Revolution and thinking about like what could the future look like in a mechanistic view. Mm-hmm. And then postmodernism is sort of like, there's multiple different truths and it depends on our context. Like that's how we'll understand how we're situated within the truth. So like, just like the acknowledgement that there are like multiple realities that exist. That's where you get into like critical theory, simulacra, Baudrillard, all these really interesting concepts I learned from my media studies professor at Berkeley. Shout out Marina Levina. And now we're like in this space of metamodernism, which is after that, which is sort of like even further kind of like removed. And also I'm still trying to wrap my head around like metamodernism, but it's like the idea that multiple ideas exist and are real and they're in opposition to other ideas. But it also like brings in aspects of like pre-modern belief and all of this stuff. Mm. But the reason I wanted to bring it in is because the term metamodernism, according to the Wikipedia article I read last night, was in part inspired by a work by Plato called Metaxy. And meta is by definition, is something that goes between two poles, but also beyond the poles. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm just kind of thinking about, like, how Twitter or even, like, Facebook, aka Meta, LOL, are these, like, spaces where you could kind of, like, observe or interact with someone on, like, the opposite end of the spectrum from you. But also their existence moved us beyond those poles and have, like, normalized the left and the right really, really far, where it just makes it harder. Like, the further we, and, you know, thinking about, like, the different kinds of modernism, all of it is sort of, like, pulling away from, like, a central truth. Because, like, originally modernism was, like, the idea that there's one absolute truth. But postmodernism, metamodernism move really far away to there being multiple truths. And then it is disorienting and hard to figure out, like, what is, air quotes, like, reality or, like, the right.
Well, I mean, that makes me think of, you know, from 2008 to 2016, I feel like the trope you heard was, oh, we're just so polarized as a country, you know? And I feel like since Trump was elected, you're right, like, we've moved beyond that. Like, it's something else now. It's something beyond polarization. It's almost that this polarization has given way into people being able to sort of, yeah, create their own truth, buy into their own narrative, opt in to the things that comfort their pre-existing worldview on both sides. And that has sort of lent itself to this, you know, very dangerous reality we live in, especially today, where it's like one of these, on one end of this spectrum, you know, there is a side that is going to deny, or at least attempt to deny, the results of the election today. And that's a very dangerous and, you know, borderline, well, let's just, it's a fascist sort of place to live, and we live here and we have to deal with that reality. And I think you and I can both agree that we think we are rooted in truth, and, you know, we sort of follow where the facts lie, and we do that by following multiple verifiable sources of information that we trust, but we can't rely on sort of the institutions to prop it up in the way that they have historically. And I think that's a really scary kind of place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one thing that was very interesting you said last night, after we watched, like, the John Oliver, I looked at you and I was like, holy shit, this is just, like, Parable of the Sower, which is this book by Octavia Butler, which, if you haven't read,
you should read it.
Yeah. But in it, yeah, basically, like, you can't rely on politics at all anymore. And you were like, yeah, but, like, Octavia got it wrong. I think, what'd you say?
I think she thought that the decline into fascism, like, the fascists would be smarter than they are, but really maybe what it is they just need to be louder. Like, and they are louder. And it's just like, I think Octavia gave them too much credit for being these masterminds, when in reality, they just need to yell. And, you know, eventually people will get tired with arguing with somebody that just wants to stick their fingers in their ears and, you know, mute you out and yell over you. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Which is a plug for also reading Don't Think of an Elephant. Anyways. Let's move into the near distant future.
Sure.
What are some of, like, the markings of a world that you want to live in?
Well, I think it would probably start with, you know, more empathy. I think, you know, I feel like, you know, this is something that was exacerbated by the pandemic, but definitely existed prior to it. Just people don't give each other the benefit of the doubt or credit anymore, especially strangers. And not to say that I'm like, you know, looking upon each stranger and being like, you know, oh, this person's probably great. But I know you and I have, when we're in the car together, when we first started dating, you know, people would, like, cut us off or, you know, do something in the road. And I remember I told you, like, the way that I always see it is, like, it's easier for me just to pretend that that person is having, like, the worst day of their life. And, like, that helps me sort of rationalize maybe them being, like, an asshole or something and move along with my day without it sort of impacting me in any way. And I feel like we're just losing that ability to look beyond ourselves and just be like, oh, well, you know, that person might have it rough. And I know it's, like, the whole phrase of you never know what somebody's going through or whatever. But I think that can even just be, like, toned down and applied. And I think that would get us to a better spot. And yeah, I think you know, we've talked about ways in which, as a collective, like, workforce, conditions can be improved, especially, yeah, if we're gonna have to face the reality of capitalism, like, what can we do to make it more bearable for individuals?
Yeah. And that's, like, that reminds me of this tweet, ironically, that I saw that was like, if Twitter workers had been unionized, then Elon Musk would be, like, having the worst day of his life.
Yeah, referring to the layoffs, right?
Referring to, like, the layoffs. Yeah. It'd be like, he just, like, wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I've always been a big believer in collective bargaining and unions. I think I learned that from an early age, probably from The Simpsons. But also, I'm a big fan of baseball, and I personally believe that the Major League Baseball Players Association is one of the most powerful unions in the world. Granted, they have not been infallible, especially in their treatment of minor league players, but really since the 70s and 80s, this has been a union that has been able to stand up to management through their, you know, their solidarity. And granted, they've had to go on strike multiple times over the past couple years, or past couple decades, I should say. But, you know, you look at what baseball players are paid, and there's always that phrase like, oh, why should a baseball player make more than a teacher? And that is totally fair. But the argument there is that teachers should make more, not that baseball players should make less, because baseball players are just being compensated relative to the value of their output. And they understand that they are the product. They understand that they are what people pay to see. They understand that their labor has value. And so for me, I've always looked to them as like sort of this beacon, the shining example of like what labor relations could be like in this country, and, you know, what we should strive towards. And I think for me, I've told you, I understand that baseball is an incredibly boring sport to watch. It's incredibly, like, it's something that you can passively watch.
Well, baseball is just so stressful.
It is stressful. Playoff baseball, but it's also like crack cocaine. It's just like, it's amazing. It's the best. I'm not saying crack cocaine is amazing, but playoff baseball, there's nothing like it. But really what interests me is the labor dynamics. I think that is the primary driver of why I'm so interested in the sport, is because you have sort of a very, you know, you have a collective group of players that are exemplify great solidarity. And as such, they're able to drive their wages up continuously. And they're, you know, they're constantly making more and more money as the sport makes more and more money. They're constantly taking more chunks of revenue. And, you know, I think if we could sort of apply those principles to other fields, whether it be tech or retail or healthcare, you know, like if people understood that ultimately they are
the people that are, they're the ones that are providing value.
Exactly. You know, it's like sort of the Marxist view of it. It's just like, and I think baseball is sort of the one place where I look at it and I'm like, oh, they've got it figured out. And I think you're sort of seeing it play out in other areas too, like whether it's the Amazon warehouses, like that one in Brooklyn, or you're seeing certain Starbucks stores start to unionize. I know that Apple retail employees are starting to unionize. I think people are starting to understand that through like collective action and solidarity, they'll get much further than sort of the individualism that we've all been tricked by over the past, I don't know how long, really.
Well, 40 years.
Yeah, I'd say since Reagan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Let's call a spade, fuck Ronald Reagan.
Fuck Ronald Reagan, yeah.
Laughing up at us from hell.
Pretty much.
and yeah, fuck him for life. Yeah. He's the worst person to have ever walked the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were a lot, there but a lot. He's one of the worst.
Yeah, one of them for sure.
But yeah, basically like his destruction, all out like destruction of labor unions in the 80s. I think like our lifetimes have been devoid of seeing really, really strong unions unless you have like had a family member. Like my dad was part of like the Communication Workers of America. And so I saw how like the CWA like supported him throughout the years and like various times. And also, you know, wasn't without like their faults, but like ultimately his job was protected many times over by like the support that had by being in a union.
You know, one quick aside, and we'll go back to it, but it's actually a funny what if alternate history that I don't really want to think about, but when the Baseball Players Association was basically looking for a new union leader in the mid-60s, they approached a man named Marvin Miller, who I would encourage you to research. He's one of the great sort of labor organizers of all time. He's the reason that the Baseball Players Union is as strong as it is today. But they originally approached him and Nixon Dooley and said, we'd like you both to work together. And Marvin Miller refused to work. He was like, no, I'm not working with that clown. And that is like how, but it's just like interesting to think, what if they had partnered? What if Nixon had like done this, you know?
Was that before he was governor?
He was a congressman at the time. Yeah, I think. Whoa. So it was just like, yeah.
What if Nixon had been radicalized by Marvin Miller?
Yeah, that too. Yeah. What if Nixon had like basically just been a ball player, you know? Like, what if Nixon had wanted to play ball? But yeah, I think it's they are, to me, they've always have been the shining example of like what we could achieve, and like a group of people that sort of, you know, understand their worth. And I think, you know, we are constantly being tricked into believing that our output is replaceable. But that's just a trick by management, and it's like an age old trick by management. And so, you know, I look to this group that's only been, you know, super powerful for, let's be honest, like 50 years. But they, I feel like they have a lot to teach us. And that's a big reason why I watch a game that everybody's like, why do you keep up with this dying sport? I'm like, you don't understand the beauty of it. You don't understand the beauty of like the negotiations and stuff, and the fact that there's no salary cap and blah, 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 blah. Also, day at the ballpark is super fun. But yeah, I think that's the big reason. And I look to them for a shining example of what we could achieve collectively.
And to begin to wrap up, like, what are things, like, when you think about the world that you want to live in on an individual level, like, what are things that, like, you know, anyone who's listening could start doing themselves?
Sure. Well, I hate to be like, I feel like most of your listeners will probably listen from New York. So I hate to be, what is her name? Kathy Hochul. I don't know, but you got to vote today. Like, yeah, I hate to be Joe Biden in your inbox, Stacey Abrams in your inbox, but you got to vote today. You know,
there's got to be like a truth to support. Yes. Otherwise, it's like, yeah,
we can't let
the right just wins.
We can't let the fuckers win. Like, we need to like vote down their fuckery. And I know that's like Joe Biden saying, well, if I just get two more senators, we can codify Roe v. Wade. It's like, fuck you. You should be able to do this regardless. You know, like.
You should have tried to do that when you were in Senate.
Yeah, like, exactly. But, you know, there is some, it is a bit, we can't just be defeatist about it. We can't just like be like, oh, well, the system is fucked, so I can't engage in it. We do need to engage in it to an extent. And voting really is the minimal amount of civic engagement that you need to perform. So I'd say you have to vote today. I know it's, you've heard it a million times, and each time you hear it, it probably makes you a bit more angry.
And what if they're listening and it's not Tuesday anymore?
Well, then I would say, find ways to, you know, try and practice empathy more. I think one thing that we've talked about is, you know, Elon Musk is just such a fuck because he's just completely devoid of it. And, you know, he just doesn't understand how his decisions can impact people. I remember when.
Or he does and he just doesn't care.
Either he's a sociopath. Which is worse, you know, like, which is worse, like the ignorance or the maliciousness. It's like, that's like sort of the question.
The impact is the same.
Yeah, but that's the question of our time, really, is like, which is worse, the ignorance of your actions or the like understanding of the maliciousness of your actions and still going through with it anyway. But, you know, I think for me, a way that I've been really able to practice empathy or, you know, learn compassion is through my cat, Daisy. I think there's something to be said for like learning things from a different species. I know it sounds kind of weird and strange, but I think like there's something very unique about it. And there's something to be said for engaging with a companion that ultimately has your unconditional love and like constant benefit of the doubt, because, you know, a lot of people don't deserve that necessarily, but it's hard to look at an animal that is your companion and think that they don't deserve that. Especially I would encourage people to rescue rather than to shop. Also volunteer with a local animal shelter. That's something that I've been doing recently. That brings me a lot of joy and empathy. And yeah, just like, I don't want to go into like a full like self-care monologue, but like find ways in which you can like derive comfort as things around you spiral out of control. Because if you can't at least take care of yourself, then it's impossible to take care of others. We learned that in our disaster preparedness course. It's like you need to at least be prepared yourself. And if you're not prepared yourself for an earthquake or a fire or a natural disaster, there's no way you can actually help the people around you. So it really starts with taking care of yourself. The way that I've been doing that and the way that I recommend other people do that is to find some sort of companion, whether it's a hamster or fish or something that you care for. And I know you believe in sort of plant care, right? Like,
yeah, just like taking care of a plant.
Well, you believe that as like a collective action that would benefit people, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I think just like learning to care for like, yeah, a being other than yourself, like learning what it needs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's similar to yours. It's kind of also, you know, bucolic, a return to nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just like understanding like the life cycles of other living beings rather than like being so self-absorbed. And I think like a lot of like the issues that we see in like late stage capitalism and climate change, like mm-hmm. all of it is kind of this like mechanistic
mm-hmm. yes.
disconnect from like the earth.
Yeah.
So like whatever way you can figure out how to like connect back with like the flora and the fauna,
yes,
I think is revolutionary.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that. I remember I told you this, that so back to baseball, because my mind can really think about three things at a time, and one of them is always baseball or Shohei Ohtani. I remember when the Dodgers lost in the playoffs about a month ago, I was like, you know, usually when that happens, and it happens quite a lot, the Dodgers never really make it to the World Series or win the World Series. But this was the first year that immediately after I'd had to explain the loss to my cat. And I was
you decided to explain.
I decided to, but I was like, Daisy, the reason I'm bummed out is because my stickball team lost to the San Diego stickball team. And now I'm bummed out. And when you are able to contextualize something like that and explain it to something that has no vested interest or no stakes in that, it helps you understand certain like things that are important, and it helps you put things in perspective. And I think that can be true of anything, you know, like I said, I'm recently sort of undergoing like a career change. And when I explained that to my cat, she was like, well, as long as my food is here, I don't give a shit. And you know, that helps, right? Like,
and she probably said, meow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or, you know, she got on my lap anyway. And so I think, like you said, you know, learning to care for something that's not yourself or, you know, learning to care for yourself is important, obviously, but then learning to care for something
beyond yourself,
but also something that is you have to communicate with in a different way and learn its needs in a different way, I think, you know, is really important for sort of being able to project how you could do that with other people in your inner circle and then more collectively as well. And so, yeah, I think if you can engage with a plant, if you have the means, or if you can, you know, adopt an animal, if you have the means, I think that is something that ultimately teaches the empathy that we're sort of, it's eroding along with the truth, because we feel like I know you mentioned this yesterday. It's like, it's really great to have something that you don't feel like you're in direct competition with, and have something that, you know, you understand your relationship is not necessarily symbiotic, but you know, it provides you with, you know, sort of a unique perspective on things that you may not be able to get otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say that the nature of the relationship is symbiotic. It's just like a harder, or like you like kind of have to like tune in to see like the reciprocal.
Yes.
The reciprocation.
Yes.
So it's like, it's kind of like, now I definitely was someone who bought like a bunch of plants during the pandemic, and it's like, it's been so dry since like the seasons have changed, but I feel like I breathe easier in my apartment because like the plants are providing me humidity, mm-hmm. and like also just like the ability to like see how much like a plant has grown has been like really compelling in a way to like see time change, considering I've been like in my apartment for the past 3 years at my computer.
Yeah, totally.
Doing my little computer job.
Yeah, I guess just the last thing I'll say is like to engage with something where you understand the terms of the relationship are not a quid pro quo. Like you understand that, you know, the reciprocity will take a different shape than you're used to with other people, and sort of being able to apply that to your relationships with people, I think is really valuable. And I think we're losing sight of as we sort of move past this polarity, like, just, you don't give people benefit of the doubt. People, you know, sort of don't display the patience and willingness to learn from one another. So I think we need to sort of, like you said, return to the earth to find that place where we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Great. Thank you for joining me.
Of course.
In your apartment with your cat.
Anytime.
On your couch.
Anytime.
And yeah, we'll catch you at the in the near distant future. Mm-hmm.